You're listening to the Chapman Cast, a podcast about religion and life.
Welcome to the Chapman Cast. My name is Pierce, and today I'm joined by Kevin Roth, a licensed marriage and family therapist. And before we get started, Kevin, I just wanted to check in. How are you feeling today?
Good. Really glad to be here and speak with you in my office.
Well, it's good to be here. We're actually next door neighbors, and it's the first time I've really been able to check out your office, and I must say it's pretty nice. Now, Kevin, I wanted to ask you about emotions. As a therapist, obviously you help people deal with their emotions. I've heard you talk a little bit about what emotions are and what they're not. But what got you started thinking about emotions in this sort of more critical fashion? I mean, we all think about emotions, but it seems like you've really been thinking a lot about it.
Well, I would say it happened in my 20s after I had gone through a second or third breakup with someone I'd been dating for a while. And I would have very intense emotions, but I would keep them hidden inside of me and I didn't want anyone to see them. And I remember really struggling. I had been dating this person for about a year and a half when we broke up. Very, very intense emotions. And I remember going to a bookstore in Southampton, and I went to the self-help section, and I was mortified to be there. So I grabbed a Sports Illustrated magazine that was in the magazine rack right next to it and took it and peered over at the self-help, and I saw a book on intimacy. And I was like, ah, that's what I have struggles with, is being close with people. As I read about it, I didn't feel so alone or so strange, and it told me a lot about emotions. At the time, I didn't know what was going on, that they were pretty intense, and it helped me understand it and make sense out of it. In my work, that's what I try to help people do, is understand, make sense out of what's going on inside of them so they don't feel so odd or out of place or out of control. Maybe feel a bit more comfortable, and so they don't have to go through whatever it is they're going through alone.
I think a lot of people can relate to that feeling of wanting help and wanting answers, but being embarrassed to look like you need help. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about that, seeking help of any sort.
Usually we have a story about what seeking help means. So for example, as a man, I might say, well, I should be able to figure this out or work this out on my own. So to seek help is a sign of weakness. So we have a story running. We do need it, and it creates a little bit of a conflict inside. So we want to look at the stories or the belief I have inside my head that might be my getting in my way of getting the help that I need.
So in other words, we've got one way of interpreting our entire life that says, I am not the kind of person that needs help. But I'm wondering, is there then the kind of person that says, I really do need help? And when they hear the word therapist or counselor, they think, oh, yes, automatically.
Well, if you talk to a European, they'd say Americans do, that Americans are much more inclined to seek help or not see it as an odd behavior or a sign of weakness. So part of it is cultural. I think women tend to be more inclined to seek help or less embarrassed about doing it. Men, there's more images about that's weak, or you're being a girl if you need help, suck it up. My experience is sometimes we are going through something really difficult, and it doesn't hurt to have someone come along to help us. Just like if you're going to climb Mount Everest, you might want to ask a Sherpa to come along and help you climb up if you haven't been up there before.
That makes a lot of sense. I have a question about emotions then. We're talking about this anxiety or fear or suspicion that some men have with counseling. Say their wife says, hey, maybe we should seek marriage counseling. And then they immediately have an emotional reaction. What's going on there?
Well, I would say they're making up a story in their head, which is going to be driving their emotions. And I can get into that a little bit later. But why does she want me to get help? Does she think I've done something wrong? We might get defensive. It's never fun to hear, hey, something's wrong in the relationship. So it can also be pretty scary to hear that.
So you've used this term story a number of times. And that we've got a story that we tell ourselves about anything in our lives, and that may influence our emotions. What are these stories that we have?
Whenever I do this, I usually tell the story of the barking dog. And so maybe I could do that right now. let's say there's two people meeting with me in my office, and we'll say their names are Kevin and Pierce. That's even better. Kevin and Pierce. And it turns out when Kevin was a young boy, he was in a bad accident. He was bit by a dog in the face. And ever since then, Kevin has been afraid of dogs. Pierce, on the other hand, when he was a young boy, his family bred dogs, and Pierce loves dogs. So if listeners could imagine these two people being in a room and all of a sudden they hear a dog barking, what's going to happen? How's Kevin and how are Pierce going to react to that dog?
Well, I would say that Kevin's going to act incorrectly and be afraid of the dog. And Pierce, me, I'm going to act correctly and welcome the dog into my arms and pat it and think that Kevin's kind of being silly.
Interesting. Yeah. How did you know how each person was going to react? And the answer typically is, well, their experiences. Kevin's had a bad experience with dogs. Pierce has had a good experience. When Kevin saw the dog or heard a dog, he's going to put a story to that. Oh, dogs are dangerous. And when he thinks dogs are dangerous, he's probably going to feel scared, right? So you have some kind of stimulus. You put a story to it. You try to make sense out of it. And those thoughts tend to drive your emotions.
What's interesting to me is, and I was kidding a little bit on this, was how ignorant we are of the other person's story. Yeah, I'm joking that I would say that Kevin's being silly for being afraid of the dog, but that's because I'm completely unaware of the other person's experience. So you're talking about how emotions are a response to stimulus. What is it stimulating? When I have a fear, what's going on? Like, is it that I know about dogs in a negative way, or is there something more there?
What I would say, human beings, people are meaning makers. We try to make sense out of all the various stimulus that comes in. That's what I mean by the story is how we make sense. We piece together all these things that we're observing. So if I've had a bad experience with dogs, hey, they bite, the tendency would be to think that dogs are dangerous. And what we also tend to do then is universalize that, like, well, that happens all the time. Rather than just say, well, that time a dog was dangerous, it doesn't mean that dogs are always dangerous. So again, that's the story that we put to it. And a lot of stories or the narratives in our head through which we kind of see the world are based through our growing up. So as we grow up, we have early experiences which tend to shape the way we see the world. Maybe the world is a friendly place, or maybe the world isn't such a safe place and you need to be on guard.
So it seems like the perspective that one brings into any situation colors a lot of the way we respond to it. So what do I do when I do feel afraid of, say, a dog, even if I intellectually know that the dog isn't necessarily dangerous? I don't know if the dog is dangerous. I only know that I've got this fear. That's what I know.
Well, again, our brain is trying to make sense out of the information, the data, the stimulus that it's receiving. And so the brain turns on the body and says, uh-oh, danger, and it activates the body. And so you might feel those emotions that we're calling fear. And usually you feel fear when there's danger or you're lacking information. So what do you do? I would say if you're in a position where you can think about it, you could say, do I really need to be scared right now? Oftentimes you have to react right away. You don't have time to think. But sometimes you can think and say, well, just because I'm feeling this, does it necessarily mean that what I'm feeling is true? Feelings aren't facts.
So what you're saying is sometimes what I'm feeling might not be true. So you're saying that I'm not feeling angry or I'm not feeling afraid?
Well, I think whatever you're feeling is true, but whatever you're thinking about it or the story might not be true. I could be feeling fear, but the story, hey, dogs are dangerous, might not be necessarily true. It's my truth, dogs are dangerous because I've had bad experiences with them, but it doesn't mean all dogs are dangerous. So oftentimes what we want to look at is, well, I have my truth, my story that drives my feelings, that drives my world, and your story might be different than mine. And oftentimes what happens is we battle over whose story is the right one. And so as a working with couples in marriage therapy, often find couples battling over whose story is the right one. Is the dog dangerous? Is the dog safe? Should the toilet paper be up or down. There's lots of different things that we battle over.
I wonder if a lot of these battles that anybody has over whose truth or whose story is accurate, I wonder if part of the problem is that we're unaware of the fact that they actually could be having a different story. We're simply unaware of their perspective. And we're unaware of the fact that we could have a bias. Is reality in life just one biased perspective after another? Or is there some kind of real truth and story that we can come to?
The way that I would view it is that we each have our bias. And then if we're in a relationship, we create our truth, like the couple's truth. So there could be your truth, your wife's truth, and then together you create your truth. But when we battle, it doesn't become our truth, it becomes your truth or her truth, and we wind up maybe not feeling as close, or that person really doesn't love us or respect us because they always get their way, or if they love me, they would agree with me more. So we get into these stories about what your agreement means, and that's where things get complicated, I think. And what you're suggesting is if we could begin to imagine, oh, you're just seeing things differently, and this is an opportunity for me to get to know you better rather than feel threatened, that opens up pathways for healing and, I think, more closeness in our relationships rather than the battling that we often see.
But I guess it's all assuming that people can not necessarily react emotionally instantaneously. Because you were saying how sometimes when we get some kind of stimulus, some kind of thing happens to us, and we have an emotion, that it's just like lightning. It happens. It might be useful to reflect on that and think, oh, well, this is my emotion that I'm having. But realistically, how often do we have that opportunity? Can we train ourselves to be less emotionally attached? And do we want to be?
Well, I'm not saying emotions are bad. I think emotions are wonderful, but we don't want our emotions running us. So what I mean is when you have an emotion, let's say that dog, you hear a dog or you see a dog and you've had a bad experience with it, the old part of your brain, the cerebellum, is going to, boom, react, beat of light, and faster than you can consciously think, which is the frontal part of your brain, right? So you're going to have your automatic reaction. So what I'm suggesting is that you could maybe pay attention to your body, and if you notice what's going on or the information that your emotions convey, you can be in a position to maybe think, what's going on here, or do I really need to be angry right now? So you could feel anger, let's say, in your stomach after someone says something that's hurtful or you disagree with, but you don't have to act on it right away and maybe slow things down. That's one way you can work with your emotions. Just slow it down a little bit. It doesn't have to act so fast. And it's not that we're trying to avoid them. We just don't want them running the show.
I love the idea that I can look down on my thoughts and on my feelings and sort of play referee to them. But when I'm doing that, I'm wondering, what relationship should I have to my feelings? Because I'm reminded of this old Star Trek, I think it's the fifth movie, where there's this guy trying to take away everyone's emotions or their pain. And the captain says, I need my pain, because that's how he identifies himself. And I guess I relate to that. Isn't some aspect of me fundamentally my emotions?
Sure. It's your heart. It's your love, right? And I guess I'm not suggesting that we need to run away from our emotions, but I think what often happens is our emotions control our behavior. I know for me, I always thought that anger meant yelling or hitting or crying, a really intense emotion. So when I became a young man, I said, I don't want to be angry. So I thought that emotion was a bad emotion because I equated it with the behaviors that go along with it. So really, I think what we're trying to do is we can have our emotions, but we want to separate our behaviors from them and not let our emotions dictate our behaviors, especially bad behaviors. So if I'm hurt by something my wife says, does that give me license because she hurt me to call her a name or to mistreat her or to give her icy silence? We often feel justified to act certain ways, which can be very hurtful. And I think, to me, that's the real thing that we're after, is being more in control of our behaviors rather than our emotions.
I like that, the idea that emotions are not behavior. I suspect a lot of people, when they think of emotions, they think of how to describe them, like sorrow is crying and anger is hitting and yelling and fear is running or cowering. But what you're suggesting is that emotions and behavior are distinct enough that just because we're feeling something doesn't mean we have to act on it. But I guess a lot of people have trouble with that because it's we're not perfectly in control of how we behave.
One example I often give is I'll ask someone, I'll put right on a board three words. I'll have thoughts, feelings, behavior, right? And I'll pose this question, anger, is it a thought, is it a feeling, or is it a behavior? And I'll ask our listeners, what do you think? Is anger a thought, a feeling, or a behavior?
Well, because of the conversation I've been having with you, I'm pretty sure it's a feeling and not a behavior. But it doesn't seem like it's necessarily a clear line. But can you help make sense of this?
Right. I agree. I would say it's a feeling. And what we want to do is oftentimes people will think of it as a behavior because anger means yelling or, again, it could be hitting. And we want to separate it. So there's the feeling, it's an emotion, and I can feel anger usually when certain things happen or cognitions. So for example, when things aren't fair, if things aren't going my way, or if my boundaries are being crossed, what's going to happen is that's probably going to trigger my emotions or kick in my emotions. They'll respond. It's like an involuntary response to my thinking, and I will experience the emotion of anger. I pose this question to people, is, let's say, hitting someone an effective way to communicate to them, hey, something isn't fair or something isn't my way? When you're a three-year-old, that might work, but when we're adults, hopefully we can find better ways to communicate that. But what often happens is if we ignore those emotions or let them build, it's like steam building up in a pot. We lose the ability to control it, and then oftentimes then we lose the ability to control our behavior and we wind up acting out of control.
So you're talking about thoughts, emotions, and behaviors, and how, like with the dog example, when something happens to us, like a dog enters the room, we have all these thoughts and this experience that has formed our thoughts. So as a result, we have an emotional reaction. We then have a choice on how to behave according to those emotions and those thoughts. But how we behave isn't necessarily dictated or controlled by those emotions and thoughts. So there must be something more to us than just our emotions and thoughts. What else is there?
Well, as a Swedenborgian, my belief is that thoughts drive our feelings, and our feelings often drive our behaviors. Well, what drives our thoughts? And Swedenborg would say, well, what are your ruling loves or affections? Usually it's love of serving others or the neighbor, love of God, or love of self, love of the world. My belief is that those things drive our thoughts. So if, you know, it's about me, and let's say something happens that I don't think is fair, it might be I don't think it's fair because it doesn't help me stay on top or get what I want. And that's why I'll be angry. Now, I could be feeling angry because I love my children or something bad is happening to them and I want to protect them and I'm going to feel anger. Swedenborg would call that zeal. And zeal wants to protect something that's good. And that's going to, again, drive the thoughts, this isn't fair, I want to protect them, and you're going to feel zeal, anger. What's inside our thoughts are usually our ruling loves or affections.
What's interesting there is the idea that when we have an emotional response to something, we're still free to act in one way or another. And I like the idea of looking at my thoughts and my feelings and examining my body and what's going on inside, like you talk about, and then sort of putting it all together, thinking, what love do I want to choose? Just because I'm feeling angry at my wife, what do I want to choose with my behavior? Because if I want to still have a marriage and I want to love marriage, then I can choose a response that's appropriate. But in order to do that, I have to be aware. I have to be self-aware. Well, Kevin, thank you so much for joining us on the Chapman Cast. I've really enjoyed talking with you. Thank you for helping at least me and hopefully some of our listeners gain a little bit of self-awareness. And thank you, listeners, for joining us on another episode of The Chapman Cast.
Content on The Chapman Cast is owned by its hosts and interview guests. Find us online at newchurchperspective.com/chapmancast. If you enjoyed the show, please leave us a positive review on iTunes and tell your friends. We welcome your feedback in the comments section of the website. Thank you for listening.